Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Vound, where today we're asking, how do you produce a documentary? We hear sometimes that it's a golden age for feature-length non-fiction filmmaking, thanks to great films. You might trace the trend to as far back as 1996's Ali vs. Foreman film, When We Were Kings, or to Werner Herzog, or even Michael Moore's Singular Styles. But with the funding and distribution models of Amazon Prime and Netflix, as well as the fuzzy versions of the truth that we seem to be getting from our dear leaders, the long-form film that asks a question and answers it seems particularly relevant and often intoxicating at the moment. So we'll try and do the same on this programme as we ask, how do you produce a documentary?
The first day I walked in to this building, the first thing I noticed and was struck by was how small it was. And you realize there's nobody else. You know, this is it. There's like 30 people who work here who are setting the direction for the entire US government and in that way the entire world.
A case study for today's show is a new film called The Final Year, an intimate portrayal of Barack Obama and some key members of his staff in the last 12 months of his presidency. The filmmakers follow the team around the world as they prepare to hand the baton to their successors and work out what their legacy will be. From nuclear agreements to media scandals to the fight against Boko Haram, The Final Year is a candid look at what it means to lead a country and is a particularly poignant watch in the age of Trump, the unseen character who looms over the entire documentary as our protagonists spend much of that final year with the Clinton administration fully in mind. During filming some of the final scenes of the documentary at an election night party, the result eventually dawns as the sun rises. Those who talk and write and rally for a living are struck dumb. The film is directed by Greg Barker and produced by John Batsik, both of whom we'll hear from in today's programme, and we'll start with John Batsik, most likely the world's preeminent documentary producer. His name is attached to films about sports stars, politicians, musicians, actors and other famous faces, as well as the less familiar who have an interesting, unlikely, newsworthy story to tell. With titles such as Searching for Sugar Man, Restrepo and Listen to Me Marlon under his belt, he's a good voice on what it takes to produce a non-fiction feature that captures the imagination of its audience.
History really doesn't follow a straight line. It zigs and zags. The trend lines ultimately will be in the direction of a less violent, more empathetic, more generous world. That requires individuals fighting for that future.
I still believe the most important office in any country is not president or prime minister. The most important title is citizen.
We had already a pre-existing relationship with Samantha Power because we'd made a film called Sergio based on the book she'd written about Sergio Vieira de Mello, and that was a big... In fact, that was the first feature documentary I produced with Julie, and I produced with Greg, financed by HBO and the BBC and a few other equity investors. So Samantha was our sort of our route into the whole administration. And then, you know, at the point at which we'd established we were going to make this film, that Samantha was going to be a key character in it, because of her relationships with all the key players that we needed in our film, she became the avenue through which we could make the approaches we needed to make. But it's true, at that point, once they all knew of our film and the fact that we were going to be making it, there was a significant amount of bureaucracy that one has to get through and a significant amount of approaching and chatting to the right people, you know, in the various different offices who are the gatekeepers to the people who we actually wanted to be interviewing. But truth be told, that although it's time consuming, it went fairly smoothly. So, and in some respects, the trickiest, not surprisingly, was not exactly securing access to Obama, because he was very open to it, and Ben Rhodes, who was sort of the gatekeeper to Obama, was completely on board. But literally, because of his schedule, actually finding the time when we could be the camera crew that were going to be the ones with him was one of the most challenging things. But, you know, over the course of the year that we filmed, poor Ben was getting bombarded, particularly by me, with emails pushing him for more and more and more access. You know, in the end, it sort of all worked out.
And you mentioned the tricky access to Obama there, owing to schedule. But I think necessity, with this film in particular, necessity was the mother of invention. You find the president coming on and off stage and giving you, he feels like he's thinking about answers to questions rather than sitting in a comfy armchair, regaling you with historical facts.
Well, absolutely. I'm sure Greg probably told you that was very much the intention. And the ambition was, we didn't want to sit him down and set up 23 lights and have a whole room full of people advising and taking notes and saying what he can and couldn't say. And him being, of course, charming, articulate, brilliant and presidential, we knew he'd be all those things, but we wanted also to be off the cuff if he could be.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
Because I think you get a real sense of his unguarded personality, and I think that's one of the richer things about the film.
As I address this hall as president for the final time, let me recount the progress that we've made.
Does our current, or the current president, make that film a bit of a gift for you as well? Is his presidency, I mean, the Obama and Trump are in such stark,
yes,
such stark differences to each other. Does that make that film kind of jump out that much cleaner?
Gift is not a word I would use, because I'd give back the gift in a heartbeat for that man to not exist. I mean, for him to not be the president, at least. But certainly the film takes on an absolutely extra resonance and power because he is the president, and because and how that impacts upon the narrative of a film, because not least, you know, we filmed up to, through and after the election with Obama.
There is
and his
that
team.
Dawning realization, yes, especially exactly, Ben Rhodes exactly, on exactly, Ben Rhodes' yeah, which is, face.
Which is actually, I think, you know, I mean, I should never say about one's own film, and of course, I wasn't there at the moment, but that's one of the great moments of documentary, that the speechwriter, who is completely devoid of words. So it definitely takes on all sorts of new resonances because of that. And of course, you know, in some respects, you know, when we introduce the film at screenings, we always say, for the next 90 minutes, Donald Trump is not the president, and that makes it incredibly appealing to the people who are going to watch it.
Now, we expect the White House to need a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing to secure access. Mm. But what about some of your other projects, which are many and varied? I mean, the Rolling Stones movie is a fantastic one, the Rolling Stones in Exile is a phenomenal one. I can kind of imagine that the Stones might put up as much of a fight as the White House in terms of the size and legion of the people surrounding them. Possibly.
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose it sort of depends which Stone you're talking about. In the case of that film, Mick Jagger was sort of the driving force and therefore incredibly available to us in the film, incredibly amenable, super collaborative, almost to the point where, certainly for me, I was a publicist for 10 years, so I tend not to get starstruck, but I just have to say, every minute I was in his company, I was enthralled, because he's remarkable and, you know, sort of just grasping his place in pop culture as you sit in an edit and watch a film play down and hear songs that are seminal for so many generations and see Mick mouthing the words to them, not knowing he's mouthing the words to them. like I would a Chelsea chant, because I'm a massive Chelsea fan. He's just like, you know, Brown Sugar's just, you know, just saying the words because it's natural. Yeah. It's like totally mind-blowing. But you're right, they all have a bevy of people who sort of protect them, and they're predominantly there to say no to everyone, but happily, you know, because they approached us to make the film, they were all very available to us.
It's a great fact, knowing that, about you sitting in an edit with Mick Jagger and him kind of unbeknownst to himself miming along to the words of some of their greatest songs. These are the moments that we see in a lot of your films, actually, these moments that kind of are off the cuff, that are unscripted, obviously unscripted, we're talking about documentaries for the most part here. Is that the point at which, when you're watching back to the rushes of stuff, so much stuff presumably ends up on the cutting room floor, but are these the points at which you realise you've got a great film, or sometimes you need to go out and get something else? When you see something like that about someone well-known or a well-known story, that you're providing something, a bit of extra context, or making something extraordinary seem ordinary, or the other way around?
Well, I suppose, yeah, it's almost that. It's those moments where you suddenly see that person and you know what you're witnessing or what you're hearing is no longer about them being an incredibly famous person. It's something that would resonate with any ordinary person, you know. So as I said, if you've got a favourite song, you might watch it on telly and mimic the words. It just so happens he wrote the damn thing.
Yeah.
And what those are, it seems to me, is are moments of true authenticity. And that's the thing that I love so much about documentaries. It is the pursuit of telling true stories and allowing the real authentic truth of those stories to come out. And I think organically, whenever you do that, something special happens. We made a film a couple of years ago called Listen to Me, Marlon, about Marlon Brando, which was entirely in his own voice. Mm. And it just carried with it this extraordinary power and extraordinary weight, because it was the real man telling you the real story in an entirely authentic way. And there's a sort of magic ingredient that comes with that, which is for everyone. It's like it ceases to be Marlon Brando. I always say it's a meditation on a life, but it's also a meditation on life, all of our lives. And that's, as I said, the sort of magic ingredient of dealing with the truth and people communicating entirely authentically.
And there is something also that runs through a lot of the films that you've made, where you can focus in on very specific subjects, but universal truths are uncovered by this offhand comment. And then in 1968, this happened, or in 1986, this happened. This is something I found actually in the Eric Clapton documentary, Life in 12 Bars, that came out. Everyone struggled with all these different things. I am a Clapton fan, but I didn't know quite how mad and bad and rather sad his childhood was, and the childhood that kept on coming back to sort of haunt him at periodic times through his life and career. And the Sixto Rodriguez film, Shirts and Sugar Man, these things that where sort of universal truths are uncovered. Is that something you kind of look for in someone's treatment, or they sort of accidentally happen? Or the notion of a good story is that these things become universal, they have these echoes?
Well, I suppose when Lily Zanuck approached me and said, would you produce this film I'm going to make about Eric Clapton, I didn't know all those extraordinary universal truths existed. But the ambition we always take into every film we make is, how can we tell this story
to someone that isn't necessarily
exactly, in a way that it can resonate with as many people, with as broad an audience as possible? And can we find within it those beats of a story that are fundamental to all of us, that are about being a father, being a son, being a parent, that are about insecurity, that are about relationships with members of the opposite sex, that are about your own insecurities, that are about all the stuff that is in the Eric film? And if you can get a character who can communicate and articulate about those sort of struggles, it no longer becomes a film about a famous celebrity, it becomes a film about all of us. And that's, we definitely look for that in all the films we make.
We'll hear more from John Batsek shortly, but first, for a bit more on how the filmmakers behind The Final Year got the access they did, we're going to hear from the director, Greg Barker.
I pitched it sort of as The War Room, which is one of my favorite political documentaries, but in reverse. So that's the film about the first Bill Clinton campaign and, you know, during the election. And was it possible, I asked, to make a film like that, but with these people who've been in power for 8 years on their way out? But I wanted real access. I wanted to be, you know, like a fly on the wall, be in real meetings and have it all feel spontaneous. The challenge with people who are in office, public officials, is that they're so used to cameras and they have a certain way of behaving around cameras. It's basically news cameras. And if you sit them down to do a documentary, they just act like they're doing like a, you know, a long-form news interview. And it's very boring and it's very kind of policy-focused, and they give talking points, and it serves the purposes of the from their perspective of like how to convey a message day to day. It is not at all what you want for a documentary film. It's just deadly, you know? So from the outset, I wanted to put people in situations that capture them where there's normally not a camera, so they feel more relaxed and spontaneous. And when I talked to them, it was often in backs of cars and limousines, motorcades, airplanes, you know, no lights, small cameras, like really these tiny little DSLRs that are just, you know, look like an ordinary camera, and people started acting more sort of normally. But that was the biggest challenge, to get people away from the talking point mentality, like just being sort of freeform. That's why, for instance, with Obama, not sitting with him in the Oval Office or the Roosevelt Room where they normally do these interviews, catch him after a speech kind of backstage where he's just more relaxed, his kind of like mind is somewhere else, and you kind of and also ask him about things he's not normally asked about. And you, I think what happens is you then get people in a different mental place, and they are, I think, more revelatory because of that.
One of my most frustrating things is the kind of cheap headline political press just kept asking me, what's a bigger threat, ISIL or climate change? And the thing is, they know we think climate change is a bigger threat, right? But they want us to say that so that there's like a, then they can debate on cable news. Like Obama thinks climate change is bigger threat than terrorism. He doesn't get it, you know? And it's like, well, like one thing could destroy like the world, you know? I mean, I said, well, they're both threats. We take them both seriously. But just the fact that it's still viewed as like a political vulnerability.
Yeah, I mean, it seems that it's a nice editorial way of doing it, not to be on the comfy sofa. I guess people say different things in these different situations. That was presumably the point of you getting to do it. But also stylistically, in terms of the look of the film, it is not as if these people don't appear to be busy. You travel with them all over the world about 10 times in the process of making the film. But there is an idea of, there is a dynamism to it. Was that an important visual thing as much as getting them to say different stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it also just the way it was. I mean, we were constantly moving. So it has that pace, which we, you know, wanted to create in the editing of it, but that pace is very genuine. That's just what it felt like. I mean, they're just like, I remember one so clearly, like, we were with John Kerry in, where was it, Vienna, and he'd just finished some press conference on the Iran nuclear agreement, and the plane, for something to do with the rules of pilot flying hours, had to leave at a certain time or else we'd be stuck overnight. So everyone ran from this press conference into the motorcade, zoomed off to the airport. We had to like run from the cars into the plane, and the plane started taxiing as we were like literally just still getting our seats. And then we did one of the interviews with them after that. It just felt totally like on the fly. And that's just kind of how it was. And what I really didn't fully appreciate was just the pace of these jobs. You know, it's just, particularly with this administration where they tried to get so much done in their last year, they were just constantly on the move. And so the film reflects that. It was both intentional, but it was also just, it would have been hard to do it any other way because it's just the way it was. And my crew like was very nimble, fast, because you had to be, because things just happened in an instant. You had to be ready for it.
Now, there are many memorable moments in it. One of the most touching for me was watching Obama at Hiroshima making the speech and then later hugging a survivor of the war and the attack there. There is such a, you just hold your camera still and let it play out in front of you. There is very little, there is no editorializing, there is no voiceover, there are no datelines even in your film, Greg. Was that one of the things, did you pick and choose some of the key moments that you wanted to accompany Secretary of State Kerry or President Obama to, or was it kind of the luck of the draw what you got invited to go and see?
No, we pretty much could go with them wherever they went. So the Hiroshima speech, you know, I kind of had a sense going into it was going to be significant because he was the first American president to go there and to speak at the Peace Memorial. Yeah, it was an amazing moment. I'll never forget it. I mean, when he and the Japanese prime minister walked in, well, they sort of walked from this kind of building and down this path between the dignitaries who were sitting outside and up to the monument itself. It was total silence. You could hear the footsteps from a long way away, and you're outdoors, and you don't normally have that kind of... Normally when the president comes in, there's pomp and circumstance. This was just nothing except them. And it was an amazing moment. I mean, I'm so... And the speech itself was a really profound reflection on the nature of war and why humanity engages in war at the spot of this, you know, where the horrors of war became clear. And so that scene comes about, if you think, in three acts, roughly at the end of the first act, where it's like we set out in the first act Obama's and his administration's worldview. And I think that speech at Hiroshima, which in the news at the time was like a blip. Obama goes to Hiroshima, you know, gives a speech. We on to the next thing. Really kind of encapsulated his view of his presidency, his view of America's role in the world, his view of the nature of war and peace, which became one of the core themes of the film. And then Act Two is when things start getting much more difficult and we introduce the Trump administration and things kind of go on from there. But it was a very profound moment.
I'm always feeling a sense of urgency to try to get as much done as possible because this office is a singular privilege. All good? Ready to go? You know, you have the ability to press levers and push buttons that are different from any other job you're ever going to have. And hopefully you've set a course and then you pass the baton and you know that you're going to have to see some other folks continue that process.
Obama himself, you catch him going on and off, well, you mostly catch him coming off stage. So he's still got that, he's still in that mode. You obviously got less time with him than with your other subjects, I guess, necessarily. Did you feel that you were catching him in a stage mode? Or I guess the trick is to have him being the man rather than the president? Or did you want to catch the transition between one and the other?
Yeah, well, so I did not want like the normal sit-down interviews with, but partly because someone like him is so used to those, they just go into a certain mode. And so, I mean, they offered like interviews in the White House, though, and I didn't want any of that stuff. I wanted it to be spontaneous moments on the fly after some, just kind of backstage. I thought, my sense was, I was going to get something that's kind of more real then, and showing him with his staff and just how, you know, so that's the choice that I made. And I think, you know, some of those moments are pretty, he's got a certain reflective tone in his voice that you don't often hear. And yeah, I mean, that's just kind of, that's what I was going for. I mean, he's quite private personally. He's very charismatic, obviously. But I think people have said this about him. There's a kind of, it's like a wall, I think, that it's hard to kind of, for even people closest to him, to kind of penetrate. He's an extraordinary figure, and the way he speaks is so articulate. And yet, you know, there's a certain distance as well. So I think you see that in the film. And so the film is him. If you think of it, it's like, along the way, I began to think of it as like a band movie. You know, he's the lead singer, and you've got all these other people around him who have their arguments and all that. And then what's interesting is to continue the analogy is like the entire music business changes fundamentally, and the band, some new style of music comes in, and the band's like, suddenly, how do we, you know, what's our legacy? And that's what they're trying to grapple with at the end. But Obama, you know, is kind of at the core of it throughout, and yet he's revealed both through his own interviews and through the people around him.
My job is to keep fighting and keep working. And if I wasn't an optimist, I wouldn't be able to do this job.
I think undoing the potential of a nuclear weapon is about as serious a moment in diplomacy as you can get. And yeah, you're happy when you get something like that done. It doesn't happen every day. But you're on to the next, you know, Syria, Yemen, Libya.
We've heard how the filmmaking process happened, but let's give it a bit of context. How healthy is the documentary industry? Docs are produced for both the silver screen and the small one, but is this prime time for non-fiction stories? John Patsek tells me why he thinks people are seeking the truth in 2018.
I've been producing them for 20 years now, and we started with One Day in September, which in itself was amazingly received and found an audience, a big audience. And the marketplace has sort of fluctuated since then, but it's, for the most part, always been quite healthy. It had a little dip about 15 years ago, but in the last few years, it's become, documentaries have really become a seriously strong currency, and there are more and more people in the business of financing docs. And that, to me, ultimately, is what matters. Distribution-wise, of course, I want to get my films out to our films out to as many people as we can, preferably theatrically, if they have the legs for theatrical. I'm not obsessed with that. I think, in some respects, there is a risk of oversaturation because everyone wants to release their docs theatrically, and not all of them should go theatrical. But I think to be in the business of wanting to produce documentaries, there's never been a better time than now because, as I said, there are so many people who want to be financing those films.
Why is that, I wonder?
Well, I mean, I don't really know. And I'm sure many, many people would disagree with me. I feel like people are getting less and less spiritual, psychological, and emotional satisfaction from movies. I think narrative... that's not the case in television, actually, where narrative television is incredibly strong. But I do think the movie business has changed a lot. You know, many years ago when I was a publicist, I worked at Palace Pictures, who were like the British indie distributor. And there was an art house. There was an art house, you know, circuit. There was an indie circuit. There was room for everyone. There isn't anymore. There's blockbusters, and then there's the occasional breakthrough. You know, they call them an indie film, and I suppose in some respects, Three Billboards would be what that is today, yeah. Which is an absolutely fantastic film. But it's hardly Diva or Betty Blue or, you know, one of those films that was actually tiny but that could actually do great business back in the whatever decade that was, I can't even remember. but I do think, I feel like there's less gratification in movies and there's great gratification in documentaries. And I do think, and as I said, I'm sure plenty of people disagree, there's nothing more enriching than hearing real people tell real stories, especially when, you know, for the chance of you making a documentary about a story, it's either inspiring, tragic, dramatic. You know, it's normally being told because it carries a tremendous amount of weight and power. And if it's a real story with the real people telling it, that's particularly in this day and age, and not least since that man became president a year ago.
Is there something to do with speaking truth to power and the idea of we hear that... You know, in the UK, sort of Radio 4 and news channels as well are on the up. Subscriptions to news magazines are on the up, etc. Is there something about authenticity, truth, and real voices and real lives being presented back to people rather than, or you know, escapist, you know, superhero movies? And there's maybe the middle ground is kind of lacking. Somewhere.
Well, I wonder actually, and I do wonder whether people are desperate just to hear people telling them the truth, because we all know Donald Trump doesn't tell the truth, and truth be told, you know, the whole Brexit campaign and everything that came with it was full of mistruths, you know, and actually traditionally I guess politicians aren't necessarily famous for telling the truth. I think and we live in such a political world now where we're all so conscious of it all. I think that people probably have a real thirst and hunger to hear authenticity and truthful stories. So you know, it may well be that as part, and also as I said, it's done so well, particularly, again, documentary. you know, the way Netflix does their documentary series and, you know, BBC and, you know, it's absolutely fantastic stuff. And ultimately, people like to be engaged and entertained and thrilled and moved, and these films can do that. And so as I said, I think movies incrementally do it less and less and less, then naturally people are going to want to get more documentaries.
Did you apply the same sort of stress tests and rigor to something that is like a film like The Final Year, a political film, as to the Studio 54 movie, which is going to premiere in a couple of weeks at the Sundance Film Festival? Do they have to satisfy the same John Batzek checks, I wonder?
Well, they kind of do, you know. I mean, I'm always very conscious, and I think it's because, as I said, I was a publicist for a decade, but I worked primarily at Palace Pictures and Working Title, and they were experts, particularly Palace, Steve Woolley, Nick Powell, my brother, Paul Webster, you know, at distribution, at finding audiences for the movies that Palace... I only stutter because my company's called Passion Pictures, and I can't remember...
Don't get it wrong.
Palace, Passion... You know, they were experts at finding audiences for films they'd either produced or, in the early days, they'd acquired. And I had an affinity for that. I really loved that whole challenge of how do you find an audience for whichever film it is. And I bring that to every film we make, and I challenge ourselves and the director and the whole team to make these films in a way where they have as many access points to as big an audience as possible. And whether it's a film about the New York Cosmos, a soccer team from the 70s, or Pat Tillman, this extraordinary inspirational guy who was killed in Iraq, and his family, or Studio 54, you know, and in some respects, Studio 54, more important than a more serious subject. We've got to, you know, I don't just make a sort of puffy thing about disco. It's got to be a story that resonates for people.
Sugar Man, won't you hurry? 'Cause I'm tired of these scenes.
Something I always wanted to ask you was about how finished Searching for Sugar Man was before you became involved, because that almost feels like the people making the film were happening upon the truth as their cameras were rolling.
I've always been very clear about that, very clear. It was three quarters of the way there. When we first saw it, Malik had a cut that was some way down the road. I mean, it was sufficient for me to stick it in my computer on my big screen, watch it, and be in tears before the end of the film like everyone else was. You know, he'd run out of money, he'd run aground. I mean, he was never going to give up because he'd been doing it for so long, but he was definitely floundering and he didn't know what to do. And Simon Chin, who he took it to initially, who then brought it to me, you know, we definitely re-energized, reinvigorated. He shot some more, fine-tuned the film. And then we also, you know, part of what I do as a producer is it's not just about the making of the film, it's about what happens next. So, you know, we try and get films to platform in big festivals more often than not if we can. Sundance, then we oversee when people want to buy the film, we oversee the deals and make sure it's the right deal. Then we oversee the campaigns of the various distributors who are going to release it, and that means the poster design and the trailers and all that stuff. That's not to say we have the final word, but we, as on behalf of the filmmakers, whether it's us or Malik or whoever, play a significant part in that process. And I love it, by the way. It refers back again to my time at Palace Pictures. So there's a long life for these films.
One of the things that I've learned about being a leader is sometimes we think people are motivated only by money, or they're only motivated by power, or these very concrete incentives. But people are also inspired by stories.
My thanks to John Batzek and Greg Barker, our guests on today's show. And their film, The Final Year, is out in cinemas now, as is Eric Clapton, Life in 12 Bars, the other Passion Pictures production that we mentioned earlier on. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. My producer was Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. Join us at the same time next week, but for the time being, thanks for tuning in.